from deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe. This is VSI Radio International. Like a man of action and act like a man of thought. Pick battles that are big enough to matter, but small enough to be won. And yes, you should be writing all this down. You are listening to the voice of a sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. You may be familiar with British Member of Parliament George Galloway. A controversial figure to say the least, he was effectively kicked out of the Labour Party for his staunch opposition to his party's stand on the war in Iraq. He was implicated in the infamous Oil for Food scam, simply one scam among many, courtesy of the United Nations. Galloway is a professed socialist and has lent his support to several hardcore communists in Britain over the years. In keeping with his hard-left politics, he is a vicious anti-Semite and has appeared on, inter alia, Syrian television, bashing everything and anything to do with Israel. Whenever he seems to be losing an argument in any debate about the Arab-Israeli conflict, he's prone to start distracting the discussion by shooting the messenger and accusing his opponent of being in the pockets of Israel, loudly calling upon his opponent to show him the shekels. Galloway currently sits in the British Parliament as a member of the so-called Respect Party. Respect is a contrived acronym for Respect, Equality, Socialism, Peace, Environmentalism, Community, and Trade Unionism. The party is a part of the informal affiliation of parties that makes up the EACL, or the European Anti-Capitalist Left. Of course, the terms European, anti-capitalist, and left are basically three terms meaning the same thing. Needless to say, George Galloway is a man with whom I very, very seldom agree. Those of you who listened last week may remember that I was discussing the many failings of the news and how it does not reflect reality. I also argued that the criticism that the news is biased is a correct one. I remember when Galloway sat in front of the U.S. Senate Hearing Committee in 2005 regarding illicit payments from the Oil for Food program. Then the British television news station, Sky News, presented segments of the hearing and gave viewers the impression that George Galloway really stuck it to the Yanks and gave them a browbeating, thus eloquently defending his position and chastising the Americans. Those of us who are satisfied with the news reports alone walked away feeling that Galloway came out the clear winner and that the U.S. Senate Hearing Committee came out with egg on its face. However, those of us interested in a deeper understanding of the events looked up the readily available transcripts from the hearing and read them all, in which it was abundantly apparent that while Galloway ended up not being found culpable of having benefited directly from the Oil for Food scam, he otherwise had his proverbial hindquarters served to him on a platter by the time the Senate committee was done with him. Of course, Sky News, besides being abundantly and obviously biased against Israel in its reporting, and besides being heavily sponsored by the national airlines of many Arab countries, is also owned by the same company that owns a radio station known as Talk Sport, broadcasting all over Britain on 10:53 and 10:89 a.m., and which at night can be heard very clearly throughout Europe, especially here in Scandinavia. At that time, TalkSport carried a nightly radio call-in program hosted by none other than Mr. George Galloway. The popularity of his program is hard for me to judge. I could seldom stand to listen to more than 15 minutes of him due to the incessant Jew-baiting alone, and remember that I could and did listen to entire programs of that bigoted fool Hal Turner. Judging by the kind of callers that tended to ring in to express sympathy with Galloway's political position, I could only assume that his own spacey ilk tuned in while the decent slice of the British public tuned him out. Of course, that's impossible for me to ascertain. Listening to George Galloway on Talk Sport seemed very surreal and gave me a rather disquieting sense of how far Western civilization has fallen, and it made me wonder if civilized man had any pride left at all. I remember considering the comparison between George Galloway and the late William Joyce, also known as Lord Haw-Haw from World War II infamy. If nothing else, Lord Haw-Haw had the decency, if that's the right word, at least to defect to Nazi Germany before hitting the airwaves with his treasonous talk. How did Britain, once the freest and proudest nation in Europe, if not the world, get into such a state that a shameless traitor to his civilization could not only occupy a seat in the House of Commons, but broadcast his jubating sedition from a radio studio located only one block away from Big Ben? Still, as I was about to change the channel, perhaps to tune into something a little more sensible and enjoyable, Galloway posed a question to his audience, which to this day I find fascinating, for many reasons beyond what Galloway would likely consider. I did not continue to listen to the replies from listeners calling in. The only thing I found more loopy than Galloway himself were the people who called into the show. However, his question was as follows. Should a person of conscience boycott Charlton Heston and refused to watch any of his films? Because Charlton Heston was at that time the spokesman for the National Rifle Association. To this day, that question has stuck with me and has never really sit well with me. And it's not because it had to do with guns. It was not about the inevitable revealing of the typical European chips on the shoulder that so many of us on this side of the pond have toward anything American, especially its political system, and which, without doubt, would show its ugly head given George Galloway's socialistic convictions. My uneasiness was not even about the dubious practice of boycotts or making one's disagreement known. My concern was, and remains, the vested interest people strangely seem to have in the opinions of famous people. I will explain what I mean by this, but first I should like to take advantage of the nature of worldwide shortwave radio and the greater intelligence and interest in the world that the typical shortwave listener has by bringing you something truly international. Here is a popular song from Sweden.
Snöflingor faller. Stjärnor
There he dances with the wild one. They dance like swirls in a waterfall, wild with pride and desire, dancing like swirls in a waterfall. Den Vilde, which means the wild one. That was the Swedish entry into the Eurovision Song Contest in 1996. On second thought, it might have been ethically irresponsible of me to play that song without first finding out about the political leanings of the singer. But I digress. Why would anyone, even the most anti-gun types, be inclined to boycott Charlton Heston films? I'm afraid that I did not stay tuned long enough to hear any opinions from any of the callers who would do so. I must assume, as a basis for discussion, that this would apply only to those who like his films, as it's hardly much of a demonstration to boycott films you don't like. Even someone armed to the teeth who does not like Charlton Heston films is unlikely to watch them anyway, so no protest there. Personally, I think such an exercise is pointless. I would only be depriving myself of many things I like and need if I were to boycott everyone with whom I had a difference of opinion. As an individualist in a country like Sweden, I would quite possibly be sentencing myself to a life as a hermit, but let us consider just one small selection of the sort of beliefs and behaviors that will certainly be considered by at least some listeners to be offensive, which are held and committed by those behind the musical selections played so far on VSI Radio International. Neil Diamond has been married 3 times, and most recently to a woman 30 years his junior. While some people look down upon that, it's nothing compared to some of the other artists I've played. John Denver supported Jimmy Carter in his presidency and also performed in many communist countries. At one point, he nearly choked his ex-wife and, in a fit of temper, cut the marriage bed into two with a chainsaw. Dusty Springfield was known to have lesbian liaisons, as well as bouts of abusing drugs and alcohol. Judy Collins has praised Che Guevara and has also associated with unsavory types such as Abbie Hoffman. Even Georges Bizet was reviled by his own in-laws for being penniless, left-wing, anti-religious, and bohemian, while Richard Wagner was a vicious anti-Semite. For heaven's sake, even the music that serves as the opening theme to VSI Radio International was written by the erstwhile Cat Stevens, who converted to Islam. Now, these are the sort of things that some people would find disturbing and other people's not. The point is that to the extent that these matters really are problems, they were never problems foisted onto audiences within the scope of delivering their music. Their work was self-contained and available to us to enjoy or not, regardless of the personal lives of the people producing it. Perhaps we're offended because we as humans feel that entertainers resonate with us on such a deep emotional level and that they bring us such joy by stimulating our senses. When you think of it, entertainers have the ability to touch us on a very intimate level. Maybe that's why we feel especially cheated when those whose work we enjoy so much turn out to disappoint us when we suddenly find that we do not have much else in common with them. It hits us like a ton of bricks to find out that these people are not merely one-dimensional, purpose-made jacks in the box who pop out when we want them to amuse us. They do not simply cease to exist once we take the DVD or CD out of the player and put it back onto the shelf, and then do nothing but wait for the next time we want them to make us happy on our terms. Certainly, when we watch films or listen to recorded music, we're having a great time. However, to the performers, it was just a job, and one that can often be a lot of hard work. When we look at it that way, should we not just be concerned about how well we find that they entertain us, as opposed to taking a personal interest in the opinions held by these people, which have nothing to do with how well they do their jobs? Think of how much work that would entail on the part of the consumer if a clean conscience would require us only consuming those cultural and artistic works produced by those holding the same principles as our own. Instead of simply buying a record we like to listen to or going to a cinema, we would have to find out the personal histories and philosophies of the artists involved. I suppose it's not especially difficult today in the age of Wikipedia and Google, but does it really make sense to vet everyone before allowing ourselves to enjoy his performance? Perhaps that's not what those who would boycott Charlton Heston really have in mind, but in essence, they are only depriving themselves of something they might otherwise enjoy simply over a difference of opinion. Notice, too, that this only seems to be celebrity entertainers, those who are in the business of merely amusing us, who are held to such scrutiny. While we don't seem to care about those who provide goods and services to us, which are much more vital to our lives and well-being, we never care to ask the political leanings of our grocers, or bakers, or barbers, or dentists, or florists, or the boy who cuts the lawn once a week. How about those whose jobs even involve getting to know very intimate details about us? How about our doctors, our bankers, our insurance brokers? Have you ever asked them if they were members of such highly political organizations, such as the NRA, the National Organization of Women, or the Southern Poverty Law Center? Or let me ask you this. Would you ever refuse to accept the mail if the postman were a Democrat? What about the pizza delivery boy? Imagine calling to have a pizza delivered, asking for extra cheese, no anchovies, but then telling the girl on the other end taking your order that you insist, for instance, that the boy delivering not be a Mormon, otherwise you'd rather just go hungry. Who would ever do that? If such a thing has ever happened once in the whole world, I'd be surprised. What is it about entertainers that make us feel a need to identify them along avenues having nothing to do with the job they do? Indeed, I find it rather paradoxical that we need to feel that we know and can identify with actors in particular, when by the very nature of their jobs, they are not being who they really are when we see them the most. Let's not fail to consider as well that a boycott of this kind may simply be an act of narcissistic preening on the part of the pseudo-intellectual. Charlton Heston, that is, the late Charlton Heston, will not be making any more movies, and movie watching is a passive activity which offers nothing material. It's easy to pretend to be sacrificing oneself for the sake of principle by boycotting his films. It would be a much greater sacrifice to boycott the local supermarket and to go hungry for the sake of a principle. So far, I don't see such people asking about the political leanings of the supermarket manager. Now would be a good time for a little break. Lately, I've been playing quite a few older songs, so for the next musical interlude, I'll play a song from the most recent album by Julien Clerc. Before I play this song, I should warn you that Julien Clerc is twice divorced and currently lives with a woman to whom he is not married, and with whom he has a bastard son. So those of you who are offended by his lack of family ethics and find it so egregious that you'd like to boycott any work by Julien Clerc, you shall want to turn off your wireless sets for the next 2 minutes and 32 seconds.
Le jour se lève et tu dors, mon amour. Moi, je te regarde. Je ne prends pas garde à tes affaires en vrac. Tout autour, mon amour, le désordre c'est ton style, et le mien de t'écouter, endormi dans cette ville, respirer le temps d'aimer. Si peu de temps pour aimer tant, mais le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer, le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer, le jour se lève et je suis sur mes gardes. De quelle vie en rêve aurais-tu envie dans l'ombre où se replie ton corps infini? Le silence, c'est ton style. Le mien c'est de tout dire quand je me sens près de toi en exil. Le temps d'aimer, si peu de temps pour aimer tant, mais le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer, le prendre.
vivre sans attendre, sans comprendre le temps d'aimer. Et plus je t'aime, et moins je te connais, même si de près, là je t'imagine quand le soleil dessine ton âme comme une sanguine. La révolte, c'est ton style. À tes risques et périls, je ne suis ni désinvolte ni docile. Le temps d'aimer, si peu de temps pour aimer tant, mais le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer, le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer. Ton style et le mien de t'écouter, endormi dans cette ville, respirer. Le temps d'aimer, si peu de temps pour aimer tant, mais le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer, le prendre sans attendre, sans comprendre. Le temps d'aimer. Le silence, c'est ton style. Et le mien, c'est de tout dire quand je me sens près de toi en exil. Le temps d'aimer.
Sweden was the first country in Europe to adopt the use of paper currency as early as 1661. Not yet a fiat currency system, the use of paper money was simply to facilitate portability, and banknotes were redeemable for real money, presumably gold and silver. As it turns out, there is talk now of Sweden becoming the first country to abolish the use of paper money and adopt the use of credit and debit cards exclusively. While this would certainly entail a substantial reduction in privacy, and thus tax evasion, the purported reason is to combat theft and robbery. In an article published last March by the British periodical The Daily Mail, the proposal that Sweden become a cashless society got the full support of a gentleman named Björn Ulvaeus. Mr. Ulvaeus' main reason for his support of a cashless society stems from the unfortunate situation of his son having been robbed not once, not twice, but three times. Mr. Ulvaeus makes what on the surface seems to be the logical conclusion that if nobody carried any paper money, then street thugs would not have any reason to mug people out in the street. Given that his son seems to be especially prone to such violence, it may well make sense for him to carry cards only. I don't see why that should mean that I should be deprived of the privacy and convenience that cash affords, especially since I'm a rather large lad and not particularly likely to be robbed on the street. Besides, as an adult, I feel I'm entitled to weigh the risks and benefits involved in carrying cash and make that choice for myself. However, I understand that reasonable people may differ, and I grant Mr. Ulvaeus his right to his opinion. I'm not upset by that at all. I certainly recognize Mr. Ulvaeus, and I know that he is an expert in his field. What does upset me, however, is that the Daily Mail found it appropriate to ask for Mr. Ulvaeus' opinion at all. You see, he is not a policeman or a detective. He is not a prosecutor or trial lawyer. He is not a crime statistician. For that matter, he is not even a banker or an economist. Björn Ulvaeus is a member of the Swedish pop group ABBA. He remains famous for his work together with Benny Andersson, the other male member of ABBA, on such stage productions as Mamma Mia, Christina from Duvemåla, and Chess. I have long been a fan of his work, but with respect to the matter of whether or not to abolish cash, his opinion is no more and no less valid than that of any other man on the street. Yet his celebrity status alone lends credibility to the argument in the minds of a large majority of uninitiated people who simply will not care to consider the matter themselves. Far less well-known is a gentleman named Stefan Ingves. He is a Finnish-born Swede who currently serves as the governor of the Swedish Central Bank. The Daily Mail did not even ask his opinion on the matter. I know that in his capacity as governor of the central bank, he does not have an opinion on the matter at all, as the central bank has a mandate from the government only to execute its policies. However, as a private individual who is presumably expert in his field, he may have had some insight to offer. For the Daily Mail to ask Bjorn Ylvaeus his opinion on cash policy was, when you think of it, really silly in the context. I doubt that a magazine like Rolling Stone would ever ask the governor of the central bank his opinion on popular music. For obvious reasons, his opinion would be taken far less seriously by the readers than that of a famous musician when discussing music. Yet, the reality is even worse than that. The opinion of the bank governor would be taken far less seriously by the readers than that of a famous musician, even when discussing cash policy. This may be a mirror image problem or the other side of the coin relative to the peril I discussed earlier in this program. A celebrity endorsing a policy allows his fans not to have to consider the issue, but rather take comfort in conforming to the ideas of those who bring them comfort by entertaining them. By getting celebrities to state their opinions on an issue, it allows fans to take a sort of informal poll in order to ascertain what they think about an issue without running the risk of suddenly finding out one day that there's something they do not have in common with their favorite stars, as they did in the case of Charlton Heston. The introduction of television into the field of politics has certainly affected its essence and impacted on the elements that determine how the electorate votes. In the United States, women were first entitled to vote in the presidential elections in 1920. However, it was relatively uncommon for them to take advantage of their franchise until more than 35 years later, with the advent of television. Until 1960, U.S. presidents tended to be older, more serious father figures with a somber air about them. After 1960, in particular in the election race between Kennedy and Nixon, with notable exceptions, U.S. presidents have tended to be the young, good-looking guys. In the Nixon-Kennedy race, those who heard the debate over the radio resoundingly thought that Nixon carried the better argument, while those watching it on television felt that Kennedy did. I put this down, in no small measure, to the visual stimulus rendering the content of the speeches unimportant, and to the pleasing image of a younger and much more posh-looking Kennedy, and the positive emotional response that was generated in the minds of women. Now, again, I have to remember that many listeners will only hear what they want to hear. No, I'm not suggesting that women no longer be allowed to vote, nor do I think that the practice of televising the candidates should be abandoned. Rather, I'm interested in finding out whether indeed there is an organic connection between the advent of television and the transformation of the personage of the President of the United States from a somewhat aloof paterfamilias into a pop star. In this regard, I think that the Democratic Party has made much better use of television as a medium. From the end of the U.S. Civil War until the Eisenhower administration, the Oval Office had been occupied largely, but certainly not exclusively, by Republican presidents in a time when arguments and debates had to be carried in a non-visual form, either in print media or later over the wireless, two media in which the meaning of words matter. Since Eisenhower, the Democratic Party has been successful in winning the Oval Office by presenting their range of good-looking young fellows who visually appeal to women. This process has culminated into the apex of that methodology, as is manifest in President Obama. Here is a fellow who fills all the requirements of a celebrity from the field of entertainment. All of his speeches are empty platitudes into which anyone could read just about anything. Still, there are people, especially many on my side of the Atlantic, who continue to find him articulate, deep, and compelling. This opinion is most often expressed by, of course, women. There are even courses in rhetoric offered in Sweden that use Obama as an example of charisma. As a classicist, I can only tell you that Obama does nothing for me. When reading a transcript of any of his speeches or discussions with others, he comes off, certainly not at all as unintelligent, but empty, an empty, uninspiring shell. And I'm not only picking on him because I disagree with his politics. I can understand the appeal that those on the left in the United States might have had for Truman or Roosevelt. I can see what the Canadians once saw in a villain like Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Dare I even say it, but I even see how less conscientious people in Uganda once saw something in Idi Amin. Yes, I truly get it, though many others do not. However, I honestly cannot understand what anyone sees in Obama. But then again, perhaps sees is the wrong word. The appeal must only be, can only be, visual. Barack Obama is a mega, mega pop star, and that is why he will continue to win the support of many people. He does not have to win the hearts and minds of the people through the power of rational argument or rhetorical device. The people want to be able to identify with him, the same way as they want to identify with any other major celebrity. As for me, I would like celebrities simply to do their jobs entertaining us, such as the following two do very well. Here's a pleasant blues duet performed by Eros Ramazzotti and an American favorite, Tina Turner.
Call me baby, you're still calling.
Here at VSI Radio International, I would love to hear from you. Any comments, questions, or suggestions for future programs are most welcome. Kindly email me at feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA, on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. Greetings this week to Jim Tyner, who emailed me from upstate New York. Jim is a longtime shortwave listener and ham radio operator since 2002, just the right kind of demographic. Thanks for your email, Jim, and I hope you'll continue to tune in. Indeed, I hope listeners will tune in and try out all sorts of programs on WBCQ. There's just about something for everyone, and if you still don't find something you like, well, then why not contact WBCQ and put together a show of your very own. Celebrity is always within a context. It presupposes a common culture in which certain personalities will be recognized by a large portion of the population. And in that respect, I suppose that a celebrity only has as much fame and recognition as we choose to give him. Having been without a television for more than 3 years now, I'm totally ignorant of many of the stars of the mainstream media, both in Europe and in America. It is only by means of certain friends of mine who act as my mainstream filter that I find out about most of the people of whom most telewatchers are aware. One friend in particular is a total news junkie, and those of you who listened last week remember that I have no time for the news myself, so I merely exploit his addiction in having him filter out the enormous mass of irrelevance and forward to me only those stories in which I am likely to have a serious interest. I get 2 or 3 a week, sometimes more often, sometimes less, but as a result, many names of apparently famous people are totally unknown to me. Those that are known to me are often known for reasons that are somewhat less than savory. I was rather late in learning the name Lindsay Lohan. I never really bothered to find out what she does, whether she's an actress or a singer or a model. I simply know that she gets in trouble with the law. On the other hand, anyone who's been into shortwave radio for any amount of time will be familiar with an entirely different set of personalities who will be unknown to those who are not. While they may be obscure to many, few shortwave listeners in the world will be unfamiliar, for instance, with Brother Stair or Harold Camping. What little they do appear on mainstream media is usually very unflattering and largely inaccurate and sensationalized coverage. Phenomena like number stations are virtually unknown to those outside our sphere, despite their immense historical role and the excitement involved in monitoring them. I even encounter people who are unfamiliar with shortwave radio as a medium altogether. They express shock and surprise at the very notion that it's possible for a radio broadcast to propagate thousands of miles. Being used only to their local FM stations and noticing the limited range, I'm often not even believed when I tell them. Even casual conversation is highly limited between shortwave types and non-shortwave types. Once in a conversation with a few friends, we were discussing the growing economic power of China in the world today. I mentioned that in spite of its impressive progress, that we must remember that China remains a communist dictatorship, no matter how easy it is to become infatuated with that country when listening to China Drive. The mention of China Drive simply drew blank stares. No one had heard of it. China Drive is a daily cultural talk program on China Radio International. It is on constantly and everywhere as CRI continues to buy airtime on stations all over the world. Especially here in Europe, it's impossible to listen to shortwave without constantly encountering China Radio International in many languages, on dozens of frequencies, all across the broadcast bands. These friends of mine are all out of the loop. This sort of thing only confirms in my mind that celebrity as such is not a quality of a given person in himself, but is simply a power that the public has to give to him or not as they please. It makes me wonder if there is any value to celebrity in itself, beyond the associated financial benefits that may, but do not always, accompany it. As far as I'm concerned, I realize that there is no more or no less value or truth in what someone says depending on his celebrity status, and as such, I don't need or want absolutely everyone to like this program. The kind of people who find characters like Michael Moore or indeed George Galloway compelling are not the quality of listeners to whom I hope to appeal. They can stay on their syndicated FM stations. As a demographic, shortwave listeners tend to be more worldly, more intelligent, and more discerning as consumers of information. Therefore, I don't need to become the world's best-liked commentator, just yours.
Quand je vois ton visage dans
Thank you once more for joining me on VSI Radio International. Remember, you can contact the program by sending email to feedback@vsiradio.org. Once again, feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. I hope you'll tune in next Wednesday evening. For now, this is Paul Lambert wishing you a good night and good premises.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.